From MyDomain.com, this is Second Life, a podcast spotlighting women who have truly inspiring careers. We're talking about their work journeys, what they've learned from the process of setting aside their doubts or fears, and what happens when they embark on their second life. Today, I am beyond thrilled to have a moment with Amanda Hesser, the co-founder and CEO of one of my favorite sites ever, Food 52. Along with her co-founder, Meryl Stubbs, Amanda presides over an empire, as Food 52 is a truly groundbreaking brand that includes amazing digital content, a whole slew of cookbooks, an incredible marketplace of editor-curated essentials for both cooks and home enthusiasts, and an audience of over 13 million people. Amanda wasn't always an entrepreneur, though, as you might have guessed. Prior to launching Food 52 in 2009, she had a very prestigious career in newspapers, specifically at the New York Times, where she worked as a food reporter and editor for over a decade. She's also the author of the Essential New York Times Cookbook, which includes over 1,000 recipes culled from 150 years of the paper's best food journalism. Whew. In short, she's crazy impressive, and I'm so, so happy to have her here. And now, on Second Life, it's Amanda Hesser. I think it's important to start at the beginning. So with this podcast, we always start out by asking people what they studied in school and what they wanted to be when they grew up. So why don't we start there?
I studied economics and finance in college.
So very close.
That's exactly the reaction I was looking for.
I'm sorry, economics and finance are very great topics.
Yeah, with a side hustle of cooking. And I think I had no idea really what I wanted to do, but I knew the sort of lifestyle I wanted, which was I wanted to travel. I wanted to run a company. I wanted to eat well. And I was interested in things that would help me get there.
Got it. Okay. So what did you leave college thinking you were going to do then with that degree?
By the time I had graduated, I had, you know, decided to embrace this interest in cooking and in food in a more serious way. Mm-hmm. And so I started by working in restaurants and bakeries and taking a food history class. And I had mapped out this, you could call it a scheme, to work in Europe and study there cooking after college.
That's a really good scheme. I feel like that's sort of like the dream though, right? So you knew that early on, like you were cooking at home, I'm guessing,
well,
or like
food,
what interested
you? Yeah, food
you?
Was really important to my family and something that we all took interest in and loved. But the idea of being a foodie didn't exist. And it wasn't something that my friends' families did. So it was a little bit of something that was maybe slightly odd about our family. It was the early 90s. So it was a time when the food movement was really starting to ramp up, certainly in the restaurant world. And that was really exciting to me to be a part of that. You know, it was kind of a slow evolution, you know, but I just started exploring going down this route and I wasn't sure where it was going to take me, but it felt interesting and right.
Got it. Okay. So then you decide to go to Europe.
Yeah.
And work there. How did that happen?
I think these were the first signs of my entrepreneurialism. There wasn't a program for me to go. I could have gone to a cooking school in America. Mm-hmm. I looked into them. I visited a couple of them. But everyone I was working with in a restaurant kitchen in Boston kept telling me, go to Europe. It'll just be much more inspiring and much more interesting and really help direct you for your future.
So were they telling you like to do stages or?
Yeah, stages, which are essentially like an apprenticeship. And you can work some stages are a week long. Some of them are 6 months long. It's sort of dependent on the restaurant or, you know, place you're working at and also how long you're willing to work for free and able to work for free. So I decided to put together a series of stages for myself, and I essentially did that by networking with any contact I had in Europe. And that was through people at the restaurant I was working for. It was through some family friends. You know, I did what you do as an entrepreneur, which is, you
turn
know,
over you, a bunch of stones.
Yeah, you turn over stones and you find the right people to talk to and you find people who will help you. And I went there on my spring break and visited a couple of the places that I wanted to, that I'd written to say I would like to work for you.
What part of Europe?
So I know I'm using it in a very general term, but it's because I actually ended up working in Germany, Switzerland, Italy, and France.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
You did a big whole swath. That's amazing.
Yeah. So I put together this plan, but then I had to fund it. Right. And I didn't, you know, after 4 years of college, my mom was not that excited to to foot the bill for this seemingly not super directed, in her view, plan to work in Europe for free. And I had applied to a cooking school, but I wouldn't hear from them for a while. So I would have to go to Europe not knowing if I was getting into the school. And so I went to a culinary foundation called Les Dames d'Escoffier, which is a women's culinary organization, and they give scholarships to students going to American cooking schools, and they have for many, many years. And so I wrote a proposal, essentially kind of like my mini business plan, for working and doing these stages around Europe with the goal of ideally getting into La Varenne, which is a cooking school in France. And they went for it, and they funded my living expenses and my flights. The scholarship was really for about a year and a half. And then I ended up at La Varenne. I did get in, and I ended up working for the owner, becoming her assistant, and staying extra. So I stayed another year. But what I actually stayed the extra year for was because I had started taking an interest in writing, which I can assure you never occurred to me before then. I never liked English class. I'm very poorly read. I always thought I hated writing, but there was something that changed.
What were you writing about?
Actually, the first writing I did was a tremendous number of letters, which were essentially narratives about my life in Europe, because it was my only way of connecting with people who I knew and loved. And I mean, of course, this was before email. And
did you feel so isolated? Were you, I mean, to be gone for that long, were you coming back to see family, or were you just off working and not knowing anyone really?
Yes. I was off working, not knowing anyone and nor speaking their language.
I was going to say, do you speak other languages?
I spoke a scrap of German and a tiny bit of French. You know, I'm just speaking of the word scrap, I am a scrappy person. I came from a family, you know, where my parents risked everything and started a business on their own. And I grew up around that sort of American dream of, like, if you work hard enough, you can make things happen, mm-hmm. and you can succeed. And it's a kind of a blue collar mentality. It's very ingrained in me. And so it didn't occur to me that this was unusual. It was just like, of course, if I want to pursue this, I've got to make it happen. It was isolating, and I was lonely and probably sadder than I would have admitted. But I also felt really determined to find my way.
So you started writing by writing these letters home and writing letters to friends.
Yeah.
And then where did it go from there?
Then I attended a conference with my boss, Ann Willen, who started and owned La Varenne. It was a food writing conference, and I met a bunch of people, and I started just, you know, kind of feeling my way and thinking, well, maybe I can freelance and maybe I can pitch some stories. And I started doing that. But I was actually really taken by the gardener who lived on the property where the school cooking school was. And to me, he represented this old way of living in Europe. And he also was the connection between me as a cook and the garden where I was getting all the vegetables and produce that I was cooking with. And he was also a real character. And without understanding this completely crisply, but sort of following my instincts, he was my first subject, you know, that I really felt I wanted to tell a story about, and who could unlock a lot of knowledge for me as a cook. I decided to write about him and follow him around essentially for a year. He wasn't too fond of the idea to begin with, but I won him over eventually, probably mostly by, you know, making him a lot of jam and just being, you know, sort of being respectful of his space. And
persistence plus bribery.
Yeah, exactly. It's a good combo. And that led to my first book. So I came back from Europe with a book contract for a book called The Cook and the Gardener, which was about seasonal cooking. And it was very much, you know, sort of personal essays about the changing seasons and Monsieur Malbert, the gardener, and then recipes that reflected each month. And that became my first book. And I think I was like, well, I guess I'm a writer now. And you know how you are in your 20s. You start doing things that maybe you hadn't imagined that you would. Mm-hmm. And it slowly seeps in as part of your identity. And after that, I moved back into my mom's house and lived there for a year, again, alone, because she was away most of the year. And so I was like alone in the woods. And I decided that I would next start freelancing. I would try to make it as a freelance writer.
So even though you've just spent 3 years mm-hmm. in Europe cooking mm-hmm. in restaurants and going to school and teaching and understanding all that, you've decided now that you've done that, you actually want to be a writer and you don't want to go and work in a restaurant.
Even though I did work in restaurants, I also worked in a bunch of bread bakeries. And for a while, I was considering becoming a bread baker.
Interesting.
And it wasn't – I think I did have some clarity on the fact that, you know, the life of a bread baker is extremely difficult. You work at night. Speaking of isolation, mm-hmm. I mean, you are socially isolated, but often you're working, you know, by yourself or in very small groups. And it's extremely physically grueling because you're lifting a lot of really heavy things. Mm-hmm. And it really – it still appeals to me greatly, but as a lifestyle, it's a tough
choice.
Maybe
not so much.
It's a tough choice. So it wasn't so much that I decided to reject that than that I started writing and found that it was working and it was something that – I felt like it opened up this whole area of learning for mm-hmm. me and allowed me to do what I really like doing, which is explore topics, ask people questions, tell stories. And it just felt like a natural thing to, if it was working, keep on doing.
That makes sense.
I wasn't sure exactly what I would do with it. I just kind of – I followed my gut, which is pretty much what I always do.
And that was to finish this book.
Finish this book, start freelancing. I mean, obviously, I wanted a staff job somewhere. And actually, I got offered a job at a magazine and turned it down, which shocked my mother again, because, you know, it was an opportunity to have a, like, actual salary. Instead, I chose to move to L.A., mm-hmm. where I had a boyfriend living in L.A., and I felt like being in an urban environment would be best if I wanted to be a freelance food writer. You know, of course, I landed, and as soon as I could, I was knocking on Bon Appetit's door because Bon Appetit used to be in L.A. and getting rejected by them. And but that's the life of the freelancer, right? And it was there were many fewer publications to write for then. So I was pitching. I was doing a side research project, and actually, right before I left, I got a phone call from the New York Times. Out of the blue, I actually thought it was a prank call because the return number had a Florida zip code. And so I thought, well, this can't be real. And it turned out that it was real. And a food writer named Nancy Jenkins, who used to work at the New York Times and who had and has been a mentor for me, had recommended me to the New York Times. So I had an interview before I left. Didn't think that much of it because I just figured it was not going to happen.
Why?
Well, I wasn't that experienced of a writer at that point. I'd written about 5 articles, mm-hmm. and I'd written a book that wasn't yet published. But I had, you know, I'd gone to Europe. I had a good story, but it would definitely mean taking a real bet on me. And then they brought me back for a day of interviews. And then a second time, they brought me back to meet the executive editor, Joe Lelyveld. And I thought, he's a busy man. He's probably not going to meet me unless they're going to offer me the job. So I actually used that free plane ticket. I made a bet that I would get the job, and I took all my stuff.
Oh, my gosh.
And then suddenly I was now I was a full-time journalist at the New York Times.
Did you know what you were doing on day one?
I had no idea.
Were you nervous?
Kind of.
Or was it – sometimes I feel like I've gotten myself into situations where they're so big I don't even know to be nervous.
I would say that's a good summary of exactly
okay.
So what was happening.
It's day one at the New York Times.
Yeah.
you're shown to your desk. What do you do? Did you have a beat? Were you on the food desk?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes. And it was a big time of transition for the entire paper, and especially for all of the style sections, because you will laugh at this, but the newspaper was changing from black and white to color, which was a momentous occasion. But they were also revamping all of the style sections. So it was a time where they were also testing out kind of new things, mm-hmm. which I think worked to my advantage, because the fact that I didn't know what I was doing allowed me to kind of wing it.
So do you remember what your first assignment was?
Or
what
I do.
What your first story?
It was on miso, which I knew nothing about.
So what happened?
I think that he may have given me a couple of people to call. And, you know, I just got on the phone. And, of course, then you just get on the – I mean, I spent so much time on the phone. And then, you know –
And
you
also it's easy when you say you're calling from the New York Times. I assume people will pick up the call.
That was beauty always of being at the Times, was that, yes, people would take your call. They would make time for you. You got to talk to super interesting people, kind of anyone you wanted to.
You wrote about miso.
And I wrote about miso. And, you know, it was off to the races.
So you spend some time at the New York Times.
Yeah, sometimes. Yeah, 11 years.
I read somewhere like 750 stories that time. You get to do all kinds of amazing things. And then in 2008, you decided to walk away from it and start something yourself. What was the impetus for that?
I think generally it was just that I had finally, I think quite slowly, realized that even though I loved the New York Times and was incredibly devoted, I wasn't a great fit for that kind of environment. I am too entrepreneurial and want to create new things and try new things. But there was another key part, which was that while I really enjoyed being a journalist and I really love asking questions and learning about people, ultimately you exist as an observer, not a doer. And I'm just a natural doer. And I think that there was a deep sort of unhappiness that accumulated from that.
Over that decade.
Yeah, over that decade. While I feel like I got to do super cool things and the Times was, you know, great about letting me like change from the newspaper to the magazine and start up new sections and write books and, you know, let me kind of express myself. Ultimately, it wasn't enough. And I didn't like always being the sort of critic as opposed to the person who's really making new things happen and doing them on their own. So that was really the heart of why I left. But it was a hard place to leave. I had an idea and I pursued it on the side. It had nothing to do with food, which is why I felt like it was okay for me to sort of explore and learn about. It was a startup idea that was much more of a technology-based startup. And I pursued that for about a year. And I thought about going part-time. But my husband, Tad, said, you know, you can do that, but then you're never going to really give it your all. You got to cut the cord. And so I did. They offered a buyout, so I took it. I was actually still working on a cookbook for the New York Times called The Essential New York Times Cookbook. And then I continued to work on this startup on the side while I was finishing this book. And it ultimately, I realized like there wasn't a business there. Mm-hmm. And it was a big idea. And it was like we weren't quite the right team. But it was in some ways I call it my startup grad year or grad school year, mm-hmm. because I learned a lot. I like networked. I made a lot of contacts, kind of got a grasp of the world without doing damage. And by that, I mean without raising money and losing that money.
Yeah.
And so it ended up being this kind of gift. In the meantime, when I first started working on this cookbook, so dialing back a few years, I needed help on the book. And someone at the Times.
Because just so for people who don't know, it's 1,000 recipes,
yeah,
from 150 years of New York Times recipes,
yes,
and you had to, I'm guessing, test and edit,
yeah,
and pick the best of the best.
That's right.
So you have this huge project. You're working on it. You realize you need help.
Yes. So a colleague of mine at the Times introduced me to Meryl. We hit it off immediately. She happened to be just moving back from Boston. And so the timing was perfect. You know, she was looking for an interesting project to work on. So we did the research and all the recipe testing. And when you test 1,400 recipes, you spend a lot of time together in the kitchen. And so we got to know each other really well. And we're just naturally, you know, given our, the field that we're in and our passion for cooking, you know, we're often talking about kind of what was going on in the space. And ultimately, both felt like there wasn't any great place online that really spoke to us and that we felt, you know, reflected the energy that was happening in food, but also, you know, they kind of gave us everything we wanted and that wasn't just about recipes. And so we decided to set out and create that place on our own.
So when did Food 52 officially launch?
So it launched September 15th, 2009.
So not a super great time in terms of the economy.
Nope.
Were you nervous about that? Because like Catherine and I started our company at October 23rd, 2006. And so then we were just up and running, it felt like, and then the recession hit.
Yeah.
And we had to – I've told this story a million times, but we had to cut our salaries. We had barely started taking them. We had to cut ours almost to nothing so that the rest of our team, we could pay them. It was a really rough time. So I'm curious as to how you – figured out how to weather that time period and then also launch a company when no one was giving anyone money either. I don't know if you raised immediately, but.
Well, again, because I'd worked on this other project the year before when it was still in that climate and I understood how hard it was to raise money, the very first thing that we, you know, when it came to thinking about funding was, well, let's not try to raise money. Let's try to bootstrap this. And there were a couple of reasons for that was that we knew it was a hard environment. Mm-hmm. But I think the other part of that was that we understood that there are two different kinds of founders. And there's the founders who are really great at, you know, selling an idea and getting people to invest in the dream. And then there are founders who really like to kind of prove a concept and sell that because they feel more confident in it. And there's nothing, no way is better. Mm-hmm. They both come with their flaws and their challenges, but we understood that we were the latter. You know, we were going to do a better job raising money if we felt like we really knew what we were talking about, as opposed to just selling this dream. And, you know, we're kind of the good students in that way. you know, we do our homework. Uh-huh. We knew that one way we could get money would be to get a book contract. And it was also a really handy way to prove out our concept of, you know, building community and crowdsourcing really great content and building relationships with people. And so we came up with a book concept that would prove these things out, also produce a book, and also give us an advance so that we could actually build the site to do this, right? So it was kind of like knitting, you know, these things together. We went out and we talked to one publisher who, after 2 minutes, said, great, you know, I love the idea. How many books do you want to do? We were like, two. So we felt like three might seem greedy, but two seemed, you know, amply ambitious. We had confidence that the first book was going to be successful enough that they would want a second one. And it was a publisher. It was Harper Studio, it was called. And they were actually trying to turn the publishing model upside down. So it was kind of this perfect intersection mm-hmm. of we're trying to turn, you know, food media and food commerce upside down. He's trying to turn publishing upside down by creating a new model where the advances weren't that large, but authors would get more money on the back end. Mm-hmm. Now, a book advance is essentially the money that a publisher gives you to sustain yourself and do the research that you need to write the book. And then you get it in different kind of portions. Often you get 50% up front and then like another quarter when you deliver the book and another quarter once it's published. So we expected him to give us 50% of the advance for the first book. Now, his maximum advance was $100,000. So that meant we were looking at an advance of $200,000, but we'd probably only get 50 right away. Understanding the situation we were in, he said, I'll give you the advance for both books right away. So he gave us $100,000 to kick things off. So we lived on that $100,000 for about 18 months. It allowed us to build the site, like pay a design firm, pay a part-time engineer to keep the site up and running. Our GoDaddy domain account, you know, we kept it as minimal as possible. And it gave us time to figure out, you know, what we were doing, whether it was working. And then we went out to raise a seed round. And even though it was better timing by then, it still was horribly difficult. We didn't look like startup founders. We didn't like talk the talk, and we didn't know we weren't part of the network as, you know.
It's a whole language.
There is a whole language. And I think also, frankly, even though we had incredible domain expertise, we were seen as two editors. We kept getting, you know, who's your CTO? Mm. The fact that you're experts in food and cooking and all doesn't really, like, that's not enough in order. And I get it on some level that, you know, if you're trying to eliminate risk as an investor. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it sort of set the stage for the way we've approached everything. It's like slow and steady. We're just going to keep at it. We're not going to give up. But, you know, that's sort of the life of the startup.
It sure is. Was product a part of your game plan from the get-go?
It was.
And why was that always important to you?
The way you cook and live in your home are deeply connected. And for some reason, traditionally in media, they've been completely
decoupled.
And it has never made sense to us because, you know, we love, you know, home magazines and we love, you know, design and we love tabletop stuff. And mm-hmm. it just was all over the place. And nobody was bringing it all together in the synthesized and, frankly, handy way. Mm-hmm. And it was time to do that.
So going to having this many employees from being a little bit of a solitary human in many ways mm-hmm. in the beginning of your career, and then even so, you know, being a writer is ultimately a somewhat independent job. Are you a good manager? Are you good at hiring? Have you learned along the way?
I think these are things that you improve constantly. I think that we get better and better at hiring and better at managing, but it also the demands of managing change. You know, I'm sure you've seen this so many times. Like as you grow, managing 10 people is very different from managing 80.
Yeah.
You know, we had a discussion today about memos. And when I hear the word memo, I cringe because it just brings me back to a big company.
It's very office space.
Yeah. And it feels both impersonal and not transparent and very protective. And I was like horrified that we were suddenly getting to a size where we might actually have to start writing them.
Yeah, but you get to a certain size and then all of a sudden everyone wants to know about what's going on with the refrigerator. And then you just have to send it to everyone. And then all of a sudden you're like, oh, where are those people? Where suddenly we need a company newsletter. And I didn't want to be a company that was the sort of company that requires a newsletter. But it turns out we are because we have enough people. And that's what people want in part. It's weird when you start to realize like you're becoming a thing that you didn't necessarily know that you were signing up for.
Yeah.
And it's not in a bad way. It's just a part of growing up, I think, in some strange way.
It's funny. We called last year our year of growing up and buttoning up.
So what's next on your radar? Like what are you excited about now?
So two things that I'm extremely excited about are that we are launching our own product line. And
when?
In mid-October.
That's like tomorrow.
It is like tomorrow.
I can't believe you have time to do this. Oh, I'm so excited. I'm even more excited that you're sitting down with me right now because I'm assuming you're probably freaking out. You've got a million things to do. How big is the line?
Okay, so let me back up. So we've obviously, you know, we've wanted to do our own products forever. We mostly are selling other people's products. We have a drop ship model just to kind of fill people in who may not know about us. And we have products across kitchen and home. And we do a lot of exclusive products, but we haven't done our own brand. One of the things that we have not been able – a kind of frustration of ours has been that we're so community-oriented. But in our shop, there's a community of makers and there's obviously a community of buyers. But it's kind of like under the hood. You don't necessarily know that or feel it. And so we've been trying to figure out how do we involve community. And one of the ways, obvious ways, is through reviews, which we recently launched. But, you know, when it came to – the time to develop our own products, it was so suddenly it was like so obvious that the way to involve our community is to involve them in the creation of the products. And so we're launching 3 this year. We'll launch about 20 new products next year. And they're across all the categories. But so we decided to start with something that is kind of a classic fundamental kitchen product, a cutting board. And so what we did was we came up with a survey that asked not just like, hey, what do you want in a cutting board, but like, you know, what kind of wood do you like? What dimensions matter to you? Do you want it to be heavy or do you want it to be thin and easy to transport around your kitchen? Do you want handles? Do you want
a moat,
exactly. And 10,000 people responded. And there was
that's
one
great crowdsourcing.
It was amazing. So the final cutting board, which I think is just a thing of beauty, is it's maple because it's a really sturdy kind of classic cutting board wood material, but it's also less expensive than something like walnut. Mm-hmm. And people wanted it to be reasonably priced. Mm-hmm. It's double-sided. And then it has a slightly deeper kind of juice moat, you could call it, in the one corner with a pour spout, because that is what all the ones that have the juice groove, you have no way of pouring it out, and then it just goes everywhere. Right. So we learned that from our community, right? And so it was so exciting to see that, like, we really did make this so much better by asking people and involving them. And then we sent it out to them to test it.
And then they're going to be even more excited to buy it and share it and help you market it
We hope so.
They will. I mean, we see that with our Target collection for Who What Wear. Like, we're very, very much involved in talking to our audience from the jump. I mean, they picked some of the prints that were in the main collection from the get-go, including our standard now, we call it our heritage polka dot, which was a dummy print that we had sent out when we were asking, like, which prints do you like? And would you like this on a skirt? And would you like this on a dress? And we got such a response about our dummy print that we ended up using it and making it. It's been in every collection that we've done for Target.
So I love that. That's so great.
I very much believe in asking, because people will tell you there's so much information there and they want to be a part of it, which is so exciting as a maker that you have people who you're able to test along the way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. So 3 products. Okay. That's one.
Yeah. So the second and third will be a kitchen mat and kitchen towels.
Great.
And then, you know, it'll be a whole assortment of things over the course of the next year. And then another thing that I'm really excited about is we're creating a magalog. It's about 30 pages long, and it's holiday. It's like a holiday. We're calling it the Nifty Gifty Holiday Guide.
I love it.
And so it's, you know, there's lots of recipes in it. There's a lot of content. There's a ton of.
And it's an actual print magazine catalog.
Yes.
So. Talk about content and commerce.
Yeah.
So one of the things that we like to do on this pod is talk to people about, like, really practical stuff so that our audience, in addition to hearing these amazing and inspiring stories, also has, like, legit takeaway from every episode. So what is some advice that you would give women who are having a great career, maybe a thriving career at the New York Times, but still feel like there's something else out there that they're supposed to do, but they're feeling a little afraid about making that leap?
I would say a couple of things. I know this is this is trite, but, you know, you do only live once, and I actually found that a very motivating feeling, especially when you hit your mid-career and you're thinking – you're starting to maybe, you know, doubt whether what you're doing currently is the only thing you want to be doing. I think of your career as a narrative. And so you want it to be the best narrative it can possibly be, but that doesn't come without risk. So I think just accepting that risk and being determined to deal with it, whatever happens, because it's hard to make a big change cleanly and seamlessly. If you do it, fantastic. But I know almost no one who has done it seamlessly. And at the same time, the only thing you get by not doing it is regret.
That's no fun to take around with you.
No.
I also think that, you know, we live in this Instagram filter world where everything we present is perfect. But we also have all real challenges that we go through as, you know, entrepreneurs and as women and as business owners. So can you tell us about a moment when something didn't go quite right and what you learned from it?
We talked about this a little already, but I do think a mistake I made was not being as actively analytical about my career. Nancy Jenkins, who I mentioned earlier, who recommended me to the New York Times, when I got the job, she said, stay for 4 or 5 years and then go and do other interesting things. And I thought she was crazy because I couldn't imagine being able to find a better job. And I do think she was exactly right. Like, I should have recognized sooner that even though the New York Times was this fabulous place and I was getting to do all this great work and it seemed like this plum job, which it was, it was also not exactly right for me. And time is limited. And I am kind of cut out to, again, be a doer. And so I should have picked up on that sooner.
So one of my favorite questions is my last question, which is, if you could go back in time and give yourself advice, your younger self advice, what advice would you say to young Amanda?
Just one thing?
No, as many as you want.
Well, I would say read more and exercise more. And I've always been very sporty and I love exercising, but I'm the kind of person who's so all in with my career that I don't make time for it. Mm-hmm. And I didn't really until recently. And it's that and sleep, and it's really been life-changing in terms of my just sense of happiness and also my sense of being able to get things done.
Mm-hmm. Self-care is important.
Yeah.
And I think of exercise as falling into that category.
Absolutely.
Something that it's you time, and
yeah,
often it's the first thing to go when things are crazy. Well, before you go, I also just wanted to thank you. I know you and I have never met before, but we have a shared investor and have been on the same email list. And because of you and your response to a question that one founder asked another on this email list that we're on about – there was a gentleman who was asking what everyone does for paternity leave because they didn't have a plan at their company. And you wrote back to everyone and said, if we want equality in the workplace, we need equality at home. So we give all of our employees parental leave. And it was the simplest sentence, and it changed my life. It changed our company's policy. And that is how we operate now. And so I just wanted to thank you in person.
Oh, thank you so much for telling me that. And I'm really glad to hear that it has had
a
positive effect.
Emotional. And thank you for doing this.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Food 52 co-founder and CEO Amanda Hesser. For more inspiring interviews, head on over to mydomain.com, where we have so many more for you to peruse. If you like today's show, please subscribe on iTunes or Apple Podcasts or Spotify or wherever you listen to your podcasts. And don't forget to rate us and review us. We always love seeing you help spread the word on social. And now you can tag us in your posts. We are at Second Life Pod on Instagram and Twitter. As always, we want to know who you'd like to hear from on the show. So feel free to send us an email to secondlife@mydomain.com. Or you can DM me on Instagram. I'm Hillary Kerr, and you've been listening to Second Life by mydomain.com.